My 8-week series on Proverbs is now in its 28th week. I think we have about another 8 weeks to go. It's been an enjoyable study. For the next 2 weeks, next week is more of a break from it. This morning I want to look at Proverbs and what it has to say about human government. And this is in preparation for the election coming up. We want to pray and vote intelligently. And in order to do that, we need to have at least a basic understanding of what God has said about human government, what its role is, what the characteristics of good leaders are. And Proverbs actually has quite a bit to say about that. You're going to see we're going to be flying through a lot of Proverbs this morning, and I haven't used them all. There's a lot more in there dealing with government. Next week, I'm going to be dealing a little more pointedly with how do these principles apply to those who are running for office and the parties they're part of. We live in a strange time, at least in the history of our nation, as we see Christianity's attacked. There's now sort of a political mindset that your moral positions are not important, but they are. In fact, I think we'll find out today that it is your character of righteousness that is most important if you're going to be running for office and serving in government. When we're done with that, we're going to be looking at Proverbs and it's dealing with vices, various vices. That'll take us a few weeks. And after that, I've been looking at several different options. I want to get back into one of the Gospels. It's been, I think, about 3 years since we've done one. And I think what I'd like to do is a life of Christ. It'll probably take us about 5 years to get through it. But it's essential. Our position is Christians, right? And what is a Christian? One who follows Christ. So if we're going to be that, then we really need to know him. And we've probably started that probably December, somewhere in there, concentrating again. Our Lord, that's who we follow. What is he like? What does he want us to do? How does he want us to live? Well, in order to understand what Proverbs says about government, we start off again just with a basic idea of what is the book about. J. Siddle Baxter called it pointed precepts for practical prudence. You got all P's in there, but that's a good way to describe the book. It's the words of the wise and the ways of the world, and so it's very helpful to any government official if they would spend some time with it to direct them on what God wants them to do. I appreciate Jim Pagonis. He serves as a judge, but you'll find he's often quoting Proverbs. It is a great help to him in able to carry out his duties in human government to know what God has said so he can be faithful to both. But before we can really look at what Proverbs says about being a wise leader, we need to have a clear understanding of God's purpose of government. And so we need to look at a few other passages first. So we're going to jump around a little bit, and we'll get back into the book of Proverbs about midpoint in the sermon. We're going to start with Genesis 1. Start at the book of the beginnings. And what we find there is that Genesis 1 declares that God is the creator of the universe, the creator of time, the earth, and man. And God commanded Adam in verse 28, chapter 1, to be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth. God created man to be his regent on earth. He created him in his image in order to accomplish that. He was to carry out God's will on earth. Now that mandate has never been revoked. It's never been changed. Clarified, but never revoked or changed. It's still foundational for any government to carry out that responsibility. And that actually does include the atheistic ones, the secular ones, and the pagan ones. This is God's requirement of them. Now, Adam was free to carry out that mandate with one restriction. He was not to eat of the tree in the midst of the garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. For the day that he'd eat it, he would die. And he did eat of it. And that day, the death process physically began, but he died spiritually right then. There was a separation between him and God that had not existed before. The rest of the scriptures is God transcending that break enabling us to come back into relationship with Him, to follow Him, to know Him. Well, Adam's descendants didn't do any better. There were clarifications, more commands on what God wanted man to do, but man disobeyed. So by the time we get to Genesis 6:5, Adam's descendants had fallen so much into evil that the wickedness of man was great, that every intent of the thought of his hearts was only evil continually. And so God sent the flood to destroy all mankind, and only Noah and his family, along with the animals inside the ark, survived it. Well, after the flood, mankind did begin to multiply again, but they still were not really following God, were they? They were supposed to spread out over the earth. Instead, they decided they would build themselves a city and a tower in the plains of Shinar. In Genesis 10, we find that Nimrod established Babel and other cities surrounding it, and this is the first mention of a kingdom. Something had been established, some new way of government, human government. Well, God confused the languages at Babel. He forced them to disperse. And with that came a establishing of kingdoms around the world along language and family ties. By Genesis 14, we find that kingdoms were well established, and they were making war on each other. Mankind was still evil. One nation would decide it wanted what the other nation had, wanted its land, wanted their wealth, or wanted to put them in subjugation and collect a tribute, and so they'd make war on them. So other people banded together and they established kingdoms. Sometimes it'd be multiple cities or many groups established together to protect themselves from the evil. And that becomes one of the other functions of government, a foundational one. It bears a protective role because we are still people living in a sinful world among sinners. Protection is needed. God called Abraham and established his descendants through Isaac and Jacob as a distinct nation, as in a theocratic government, something different. Instead of a king ruling over them who would have force of arms to force them to carry out whatever his will was, the people were to know God's law and then follow God's law voluntarily, and he would be their king. Those laws were codified under Moses, with the priests carrying out the functions of national government, and the tribes and local officials carried out the civic affairs. And while that particular form of government would be unique to the nation of Israel, yet we also find that the law of Moses is the most comprehensive revelation of God's will for governments that still exists. This is how he wants them to function. These are the duties, the responsibilities that they have. They were the foundation of our own nation's laws, and though society is now rejecting Christianity, and with it, those laws founded upon it. In fact, they're establishing laws that are exactly the opposite. Well, sadly, the people did not learn and follow God's law, eventually rejected God's rule, and decided they wanted a king over them. But that didn't surprise God. He was well aware of it. In fact, in Deuteronomy 17, written within the Mosaic law, is a section dealing with what will happen and what's going to be required when Israel would have a king. What was his character be like? How would he was supposed to be chosen? And what his responsibilities were? Flip over there, Deuteronomy 17, because this is important for us. This is what they're supposed to do. Deuteronomy 17, 14 through 20, is written specifically to the Jewish kings. But the principles here apply to all government leaders. Whether they believe in God or not, it still applies to them. In verses 14 and 15 are set out for the future kings of Israel. Then in verse 16 and 17, it is set out what they are to do and what they are not to do. They are not to multiply horses, wives, or silver and gold. They were not to be like the kings of the surrounding nations that sought military might, financial wealth, and many wives. Those were things that would secure their reign and their legacy. They're also sources of pride, power, and pleasure. Israel's kings were supposed to place their security in the Lord for their protection, for their needs, and for their dynasty. It is still a general truth that when any government leader, or in fact really any leader, is seeking power, wealth, are pleasure, they're dangerous. So there's still a principle here that we see applied today. But look at verses 18, 19, and 20. This sets out what kings are supposed to do. Now it shall come about when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself a copy of this law on a scroll in the presence of the Levitical priests. It shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn the fear of the Lord his God by carefully observing all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted up above his countrymen, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right or to the left, so that he and the sons may continue long in his kingdom in the midst of Israel. The leader of any nation that is humble, fears the Lord, and will lead his people in righteousness is going to be a blessing. Proverbs 11:10 puts it succinctly, when it goes well with the righteous, the city rejoices. But the opposite is also true. When the wicked perish, there's shouting. When righteousness is prevailing, there's joy among the people. The character of the leader is important. Now, Paul says much the same thing. It's the same point over in Romans chapter 13. Verse 3 and 4. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do you want what is good? You will have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God to you for good, but if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath upon the one who practices evil. What kind of rulers do we have? What do they think their function is? So again, rulers that are humble, fear the Lord, lead in righteousness, bring a blessing. Governments are designed by God to promote good and suppress evil. And we'd say that governments really have three basic functions. Everything else needs to really be tied to this. They're to carry out God's commands. What has God said? They are to function within that. God will hold them accountable for it. So that's where they need to function. Second, they need to protect its citizens from evil, both those things that would come from the outside, other nations that want to attack, as well as evil that would be internally, those who would practice wickedness among us. We need that protection. And then third, it is to promote what is good among the people. Righteousness. Now, governments, regardless of form, that do not carry out those functions place them in a grave danger of being removed because they've made themselves illegitimate. They're not carrying out God's design, his plan. King Nebuchadnezzar learned the hard way over in Daniel 4. The Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth, who lives forever. Nebuchadnezzar finally learned and said this about that God. Daniel 4. 34 and 35. That God is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whom he wishes. His dominion is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing. But he does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can ward off his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" That's the nature of our God. As you continue through the Old Testament, look at the book of 2 Kings, and there you have played out the results of a nation that turns its back on God. Though warned over and over again by the prophets, both Israel in the north and Judah in the south turned away from God, and God sent oppressors. Then they were defeated, subjugated, and finally deported, exactly as he'd warned them in the Mosaic Law. In Exodus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Now, many of the nations throughout history in which this truth has been laid out, including in modern times. And the tragedy here, though, is not the failure of the government and it's gotten replaced. The real tragedy is the suffering the people go through as that nation fails and then destroys itself. Some other nation takes it over. That's the real tragedy. And we need to remember that our own nation is not immune from this truth. God has blessed this nation beyond measure, but we are not immune from this. The current immoral direction of much of our government is taking us exactly down that path. We need to be aware of it. Now, Proverbs gives a lot of practical advice regarding government, its officials, and the response of the people. Not surprisingly, as we go through Proverbs, it deals with all these issues in terms of wisdom, righteousness, and justice versus the opposites of foolishness, wickedness, and injustice. Because it is the moral character of a government, not its financial success, not its military might, that is important to God. How often through the history of the nation of Israel was it protected when it was small and weak, but was righteous? And yet when it rose up and had great power and great wealth, it failed. We need to look at it from God's perspective. What really is important? Proverbs 16:12 says, "It is an abomination for a king to commit wicked acts, for a throne is established in righteousness." That's where the foundation is. That's where the security is. Are we a righteous people or wicked? Now, the various proverbs are set in the time of kings and various officials that served under those kings. And that needs to be understood from the beginning, lest you get some kind of idea as you're studying through Proverbs that the only biblically legitimate type of government is kingdoms. I've already mentioned a couple of others already. There's a patriarchal. Abraham was a patriarch. There were kingdoms, but there was a theocracy. What's interesting is you're studying the theocracy, there's also a form of democracy within the theocracy. In Deuteronomy 1:13, we find that it was each tribe chose for themselves who would be their leader, and that leader was then appointed by Moses. In Deuteronomy 16:18 through 20, it states the criteria by which they were to appoint for themselves judges and officers of their towns. So there's a democratic process of some sort that's going on. We find the same kind of thing happening in Acts 6 when the apostles told the people is to find for yourselves men of certain character, and then they appointed them. Now, it's important to note early on that this emphasis in Scripture is on the moral quality of a government, not on a particular form. In fact, the only particular government or form of government that is declared as superior is one that is yet to come. That'll be the millennial kingdom under Christ. Only then will there be an actually functioning government that's right. Imagine a bureaucracy that works. But that's in the future. Now, I need to kind of point this out because it's easy for us in America to fall prey to a lie that democracy is always the best form of government. It's not. There are different types of governments that God has used very effectively. Our founding fathers understood the weakness here. And that's why they stressed that religion and morality were indispensable to the support of political prosperity in a democracy. Read through Washington's farewell address. Because the great weakness of a democracy is that it reflects the people. We choose our leaders. They reflect us. So if the people are good, righteous, just, they choose those kinds of leaders. If the people go the other direction and they're wicked, what kind of leaders do they choose? Ones like themselves. We've been watching this decline in America for a long time. We see it happen very rapidly in the so-called Arab Spring and the quote-unquote democracies formed. Our brothers and sisters in Christ have been persecuted more under these new democracies than they were under the totalitarian dictators that were there. They're dying, they're suffering, they're fleeing under democracy. Now, all governments have a hierarchy of officials. Authority extends from the top down. And there could be multiple branches of government which compete for power, as we have set it up in our own nation. But even those branches have various levels of officials under them. And Proverbs mentions a lot of different kinds of officials. There are kings, leaders, rulers, princes, nobles, rulers, chiefs, officers. But we don't really understand the exact hierarchy. The words that are used often overlap. Some of the Hebrew words are actually synonyms for one another. So it's an interesting study, but not really germane to the point of the sermon this morning. So I'm not going to go through all these types of different officials. But just understand that all these officials, no matter whether they're way up in the government structure or way down at the bottom, still have a responsibility to God and still need to carry out those basic functions of government. That's what it's about. All their duties are going to end up being relayed toward carrying out God's commands, protecting its citizens from evil, and promoting good. That's supposed to be their function. Well, we start with wisdom when it comes to what's needed for a government, or any kind of governmental leader, or actually the leader of any kind of group. We start with wisdom. Go back to Proverbs. Proverbs 1, again, lays the foundation. But it's interesting, it has several statements here that pertain particularly to what's needed for leadership in a structured organization of people, a government. Starting in verse 1, chapter 1, the Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel. And he goes on and says, here's what the Proverbs are for. To know wisdom and instruction, to discern the sayings of understanding, to receive instruction in wise behavior, righteousness, justice, and equity. To give prudence to the naive, to the youth knowledge and discretion. A wise man will hear an increase in learning, and a man of understanding will acquire wise counsel. To understand a proverb, the figure, the words of the wise, and their riddles. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. The fools despise wisdom and instruction. Now, these characteristics listed out here are important for any kind of leader. Wisdom, knowledge, understanding, righteousness, justice, equity, discretion, being able to choose between, and prudence. Wisdom is personified in Proverbs 8 and declares in verses 14 through 16 this, counsel is mine and sound wisdom. I am understanding. Power is mine. By me kings reign and rulers decree justice. By me princes rule and nobles, all who judge rightly. Wisdom becomes essential. Wisdom adds in verse 20, same chapter, I walk in the way of righteousness in the midst of the paths of justice. Without wisdom, can there be justice? These are all necessary for success. Wisdom invites and it warns. Drop down to verse 32. Now therefore, O sons, listen to me. For blessed are they who keep my ways. Heed instruction and be wise. Do not neglect it. Blessed is the man who listens to me, watching daily at my gates, waiting at my doorposts. For he who finds me finds life and obtains favor from the Lord, but he who sins against me injures himself, and all those who hate me love death. Wisdom's essential. It's foundational for the leader of anything. A government that seeks and follows wisdom will be successful. And one that follows foolishness sows the seeds of its own destruction. Must be quickly pointed out here the type of wisdom we're talking about. This is not common wisdom. It's not street smarts. This is the wisdom from above, not the wisdom from below, as explained in James 3. The wisdom from below is earthly. It's natural. It's demonic. It leads to jealousy and selfish ambition, disorder, and every evil thing. And when you think about our own governments, the various levels, what do you see in them? Does it kind of fit that? You see, it should fit the wisdom of above, which is the opposite. This is not common sense. First of all, common sense isn't that common, and a lot of it doesn't have much sense. It's not street smarts. Both of those seek to conform to the ways of the world, not necessarily God. The wise leader is going to seek out and follow the precepts and principles of God's word instead of the advice of political consultants and polling. If you have followed politics, and I have, especially at a local level, and you find good people who follow advice from political advisors that do really stupid things when it comes to biblical morality, biblical righteousness and justice, and they suffer for it, and we do too. The wisdom that we're referring to here in Proverbs is chokmah. It refers to skill and ability in the entire range of human experience. Everything from technical ability to and craftsmanship to battle tactics and the government administration. That's the general meaning of the word. But throughout the Hebrew Scriptures, this word is also tied in directly to the revelation of God and His will. What is holy? What is just? What is righteous? And it submits itself to that will. So all human experience, all human knowledge and understanding that's been gained, however it's been gained, true wisdom submits itself to God. I will follow Him rather than what I think is best, because God knows best. True wisdom is characterized by being pure, peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy, James 3:17. A king will need true wisdom, because as Proverbs 16:10 points out, a divine decision is in the lips of the king. His mouth should not err in judgment. He's going to be held accountable. So it becomes serious for him, and it becomes serious to those that he's judging over. So wisdom is the first real characteristic that needs to be in any government leader, or any leader. The second is righteousness, as opposed to unrighteousness. Really, the truth of Proverbs 13:34 applies to every government. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a disgrace to any people. That is so foundational and so ignored. Righteousness brings a blessing on a nation, its people. Proverbs 29:2, when the righteous increase, the people rejoice. Proverbs 28:12, when the righteous triumph, there is great glory. But sin brings travail and tragedy. Proverbs 29:16, when the wicked increase, transgression increases. 28:12, when the wicked rise, men hide themselves. 29:2, when a wicked man rules, people groan. The tragedy is there are so many nations have no sense of shame and their leaders glory in their sin. This has become true in our own nation, with scandal becoming so common among the political class. We hardly even notice it. It's just become normal. A generation ago, an indiscretion could end a political career. Now, affairs, prostitutes, they're not a big deal unless you lie about it or you pay for it with government money. Think about it. Because there's a whole bunch of them that are doing the same things. The only ones that are getting in trouble are the ones that paid for it with government money or tried to hide it from the press, because don't lie to the press. Now they take it personally, and they are after you. Otherwise, they could care less. Corruption, cronyism, political playoffs are so normal. They're such the normal operating procedure, it often doesn't even make the news. How many of you heard about this one? There have been nearly 600 convictions and judgments against the misuse of funds from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the stimulus funds. Even worse, there are over 1,900 pending investigations. Anybody hear about that? All right, I knew about it, but it took me a while to find a news story that said something about it. And that's recent. That was in September. And that doesn't include at least the political corruption that enabled many to legally get a share of those funds for personal benefit. Doesn't include them. Do you get the sense that transgression is increasing? Does such financial waste cause you to groan? But the economics are not the least. In fact, I'd have to say the economics of this are the least troubling aspects of an unrighteous government. It's just money. Proverbs 29:27 states, "An unjust man is abominable to the righteous, and he who is upright in the way is abominable to the wicked." They're exact opposites of each other. Since God declares the acts of the unjust to be abominations, it is just for the righteous to react to them accordingly. The righteous are to call sinners to repentance, to try and get them to turn away from evil. Proverbs 4, 14 and 15 deal with that specifically. In fact, it would be cruel to leave someone under God's just condemnation and not warn them. That's cruel. A good king is going to uphold God's law. He's going to correct them. Proverbs 28, 4, those who forsake the law praise the wicked, but those who keep the law strive with them. You keep the law, you're going to work against those who are breaking it. Proverbs 19, 29, judgments are prepared for scoffers and blows for the back of fools. There's to be a correction. But what about when the opposite is taking place? That's when the people really groan. We don't like the finances, but that's not the real problem. And that's not what causes real groaning. It's when the righteous are persecuted for maintaining God's commands. Now, Chick-fil-A and Hobby Lobby have both been recently slandered and boycotted by the pro-homosexual lobby, along with many politicians. Those particular ones backfired. There actually was a lot of support given to them. There's a lot of businesses that have, they've gone out. They've paid huge fines. They've had their property damaged. They've been physically assaulted by the wicked and angry people, or taken to court and lost because the courts have become perverted. The laws are perverted. The people groan when government takes the side of the wicked and oppresses the righteous. God warned about that. He's warned about it in so many places. Isaiah 5, 20 through 21 is probably one of the most clear statements that could be made. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. That's God's pronouncement. And it wasn't just a truth for Israel. It's a truth that's carried out throughout history on all nations. Those serious warnings, both for Israel and Judah, were eventually carried out. They were conquered and deported because of their evil. Proverbs 24, 23 through 26 gives a warning and an encouragement. It says this, these are also the sayings of the wise. To show partiality in judgment is not good. He who says to the wicked, you are righteous. Peoples will curse him, nations will abhor him. But to those who rebuke the wicked will be delight, and a good blessing will come upon them. He kisses the lips who gives a right answer. They're set in contrast with each other. Those who are in any leadership position need to be very careful about the advice they receive, lest they go the direction of the wicked. Proverbs 12:5 says, the thoughts of the righteous are just, but the counsels of the wicked are deceitful. And it has led all sorts of good people astray. Many good men have been led astray by such poor advice that paid more attention to the wisdom of the world than the wisdom from God. Now, you start off with making sure you're not getting bad advice. That goes back to Psalm 1. How blessed the man who does not walk in the counsel of the ungodly. Proverbs 25, 4 and 5 state this, take away the dross from silver, and there comes out a vessel for the smith. Take away the wicked before the king, and his throne will be established in righteousness. So when it comes to leaders, we do have to look at who are they surrounding themselves with. Because that's the direction they're going to go, is with these people they surround themselves with. Second, we need to be wise. We need to seek out good counsel. You can't just not receive bad counsel. You've got to seek out good counsel too. Proverbs 1, 5, 12, 15, 13, 10. There's a bunch of Proverbs that deal with that. Because the goal is to avoid foolishness and be guided in right decisions. Now, there's great blessing in having godly advisors. Proverbs 16, 13, righteous lips are a delight to the king, and he who speaks right is loved. And Proverbs 20, verse 28, loyalty and truth preserve the king, and he upholds his throne by righteousness. Not power, not wealth, it's by righteousness. Now, of course, the best counsel always comes from the Lord. Proverbs 19, 21, his counsel will stand. A leader also needs to be strong and courageous, because he's going to have to stand firm against a lot of pressure to yield to the wicked. And I hope when you are praying for our governmental leaders, you are praying along those lines. There are a lot of good people serving, but they're getting a lot of pressure from the wicked. Proverbs 25:26 says, like a trampled spring in a polluted well is a righteous man who gives way before the wicked. But that does happen because the pressure becomes too great for them. By standing against evil, a leader prevents his people from becoming contaminated and ensures a healthy stream. Third characteristic needed is justice. Now, justice flows from righteousness, just in the same way that injustice flows from evil. You cannot be just if you are not righteous. It must flow from that. Righteousness and evil are mutually exclusive, and their response to justice is the exact opposite. Proverbs 21:15, the exercise of justice is a joy for the righteous, but is terror to the workers of iniquity. As previously mentioned, wisdom is essential to being able to walk in both righteousness and justice, Proverbs 8:20. Now, the importance of justice is seen in Proverbs 21:3. This is a really interesting verse. It says, to do righteousness and justice is desired by the Lord more than sacrifice. More than worship? Well, think about it. Rituals of worship are relatively unimportant to God unless it is done with the right heart. And if it's not done with the right heart, he considers them abominations. God rejected the sacrifice of Judah because of their wickedness. Isaiah 1:10-15 talks about that. They were busy doing the stuff they thought the law commanded, and God thought it was an abomination before him. Proverbs 15:8 says, the sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination to the Lord, but the prayer of the upright is his delight. Micah 6:8 says, what does the Lord require? But to do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with him. Humbly with God. That means if you're going to worship properly, you have to be someone who's righteous and carrying out justice. Because if you're not doing that, you're not worshiping properly. That makes a pretty serious item, doesn't it? Justice is carried out by several means. The first of which is actually the laws that are set forth by any government, because the judgments made by the government are supposed to be based on their laws. There are certainly a lot of exceptions where judges don't care what the law says. In fact, even the Supreme Court often doesn't care what the Constitution says. They just want to go their own way. But theoretically, it's supposed to be based on their laws. So you start there. What are the actual laws that this government has put? If they are not just, then the nation's in trouble. But this is also why righteousness must precede justice. If the laws are perverted, then so too will be justice, correct? But we need to remember that it is God, not man, that determines what is just, because he sets the eternal standards by which all men, including the kings and presidents and magistrates and you name it, will be judged. They will stand before him. Under man's laws, it can be legal to be unjust. It can also be illegal to carry out what is just under man's laws. Because justice is determined by God, not man. That's why there's a contrast. Proverbs 28:5 says, evil men do not understand justice, but those who seek the Lord understand all things. I pointed out some examples last week, commenting about Proverbs 13:23. Abundant food is in the fallow ground of the poor, but it's swept away by injustice. And I don't recall now if I had mentioned this particular one, but I remember when I was in college, and I was in ag college, so we were attuned to what was going on the farms. It was a farmer in California that had been plowing a certain section of his field for a long time, and suddenly EPA stepped in and said, you can't plow this area anymore. We found kangaroo rats there. Now, why they were on his private land, I don't know. They were of trespassing, but he could no longer plow this field. Now, if he'd been plowing the field for years and the kangaroo rat was still there, then obviously his plowing was not destroying the kangaroo rat. But he's no longer allowed to do anything with that land. It lies fallow, no production to him, and he's received no compensation for it. But I can guarantee you he's still paying taxes on it. Injustice? This is an exact demonstration. There's nothing coming off the land anymore. He can end up poor. Fortunately, he has enough land he can still farm. But that's a major portion that he lost. No income. But there are a lot of worse cases than that. Most of you know my home state is California. I say that with shame. What's going on there is, you don't think it can get worse than it does. September 30th, Governor Brown signed a law that made it illegal for a licensed counselor to assist a minor who desires to decrease his or her same-gender attraction. That includes a minor who's been molested and is now confused about his sexual orientation. It's illegal. What is just is made illegal. But California is also one of the states in which its judges continually overturn their own constitution. They continually set aside legally passed referendums that confirm traditional marriage, and instead they keep pushing and trying to institute homosexual marriage contrary to their own constitution. They have made what is unjust legal. God determines justice, not man. We need to always remember that. Now, righteousness and justice demand honesty in all areas. Boy, wouldn't that be something if our politicians were actually honest? Wow. But in all areas. In fact, a good government is going to promote honesty and have laws set to punish those who are dishonest. We're certainly moved the other way. You can slander people now and you can't do anything about it. Proverbs 16:11 and 20:10. In fact, let me comment about that. We had someone falsely accused by someone of some really wretched stuff and couldn't even give a copy of the police report because the accusation was made anonymously and they were afraid that we might be able to figure out who it might be if we got the police report. Couldn't even get a redacted copy of it. And you still scratch your head and go, is this the United States? Yes. What is unjust is made legal. And you end up without recourse. But righteousness and justice demand honesty. Proverbs 16:11 and 20:10 address honesty in business transactions. We mentioned this last week. A just balance and scales belong to the Lord. All the weights of the bag are his concern. And differing weights and differing measures are both of them are abominable to the Lord. You have to have honest business transactions. You have to be trustworthy by being true about what you're saying you're going to do. Measuring things properly, not cheating one another. Proverbs 22:28 addresses land dealings and by implication, our modern society, accurate surveying and record keeping. Do not move the ancient boundary which your fathers have set. It needs to be true. And yet we do find that land is stolen this way, still. A good ruler will establish justice while an evil ruler will oppress his people. Proverbs 29, verse 4. The king gives stability to the land by justice, but a man who takes bribes overthrows it. Proverbs 28:15 and 16, like a roaring lion and a rushing bear is a wicked ruler over poor people. A leader who is a great oppressor lacks understanding, but he who hates unjust gain will prolong his days. Protector or oppressor? You see, the justice of a good king is a blessing. Proverbs 20, verse 8, a king who sits on the throne of justice disperses all evil with his eye. Just coming into his courtroom, I'm not going there because this guy's going to find me out. And evil disappears because justice will reign. Such a king will punish the wicked, Proverbs 20, verse 26. A wise king winnows the wicked and drives the threshing wheel over them. Now, that's strong language, but strong language needs to be used with the response we are to have the wicked. There needs to be punishment. It needs to be severe enough that it stops them and warns other people not to do the same. He is going to judge rightly, Proverbs 29:14. If a king judges the poor with truth, his throne will be established forever. A wicked king is the opposite. He can be bought. He can be bribed, Proverbs 17:23. A wicked man receives a bribe from the bosom to pervert the ways of justice. And yes, it still happens. He is going to adhere to poor counsel, and that results in increasing evil. Proverbs 29:12. If a ruler pays attention to falsehood, all of his ministers become wicked. They want to get away with even more. The hidden danger here is that even a good leader can be fooled by the wicked that are around them that are deceitful. Proverbs 28:10, he who leads the upright astray in an evil way will himself fall into his own pit. They can do that. Have you ever been deceived and led astray by someone who is evil? I think that's happened to all of us. Sounded good at the time, but what do we know? Relying on somebody else's supposed wisdom? And they turned out to be wicked. But the blameless will inherit good. King Lemuel, Proverbs chapter 31, was given very stern warning about women and strong drink, lest it cause him to forget the law and pervert the rights of the afflicted. And so he was admonished to be a good king. What were the marks of a good king? Proverbs 31, 8 and 9. Open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all the unfortunate. Open your mouth, judge righteously, and defend the rights of the afflicted and the needy. Those are characteristics of a good king, of a good leader, of a good ruler. You see, what happens in the courtroom is also important. A good government will not have tolerance for falsehood in the court. A corrupt one will encourage it. Proverbs 14:25, a truthful witness saves lives, but he who utters lies is treacherous. Proverbs 19:28, a rascally witness makes a mockery of justice, and the mouth of the wicked spreads iniquity. And while a false witness may prevail in a man's court by lying, he'll not get away with it in God's court. This becomes the real warning that we have to give. Proverbs 19:5, a false witness will not go unpunished, and he who tells lies will not escape. Eventually, he's got to stand before God. Even revenge does not justify lying in court or even giving a false witness a report about a neighbor. Proverbs 24:28 and 29, do not be a witness against your neighbor without cause. Do not deceive with your lips. Do not say, thus I shall do to him as he has done to me. I will render to the man according to his work. It's just after revenge. But revenge belongs to who? God. What a judge allows in his courtroom and the verdicts he renders actually reflect his own character, whether good or bad. Proverbs 21:8, the way of a guilty man is crooked, but for the pure, his conduct is upright. Proverbs 29:7, the righteous is concerned for the rights of the poor. The wicked does not understand such concern. What will the judge do? Make a judgment favorable to his friends who are wealthy? Or make a judgment that might make those people his friends and he can share in their wealth? Or uphold the law regardless of who has money and who doesn't? The actions of the wicked are seen in their perversion of justice. Proverbs 18:5, to show partiality to the wicked is not good, nor to thrust aside the righteous in judgment. Proverbs 17:26, it is also not good to fine the righteous, nor to strike the noble for their uprightness. Proverbs 17:15, he who justifies the wicked and he who condemns the righteous, both of them alike, are an abomination to the Lord. The tragedy is that even in our own nation, and I'll be frank here, our nation is still, compared to a lot of nations around the world, far superior in our justice. But even in our nation, this is common. Whether a good government is good or bad is determined by its moral character, not by its financial success, not by its military power. Keep that in mind as all this political stuff comes flooding into your mail in the next 2 weeks. Because a lot of it's going to be all about the economy. I'm sorry, it's not about the economy. That's stupid. It's about righteousness. Righteousness will have an effect on the economy, but it's righteousness that we're looking for. True justice, not the feigned justice of, what are they calling it? It's used by a lot of the communities to actually overturn justice, but it's a false justice. True justice. Justice that matches God, what God says. Truth and honesty, purity. God is the judge of both men and nations. That's our protection. That's our foundation. We will suffer. We understand that. There will be evil who will do evil things against us legally. Our hope is in God, not in government. And we do warn because God is the judge of men and nations. So it comes back to Proverbs 14:34. Righteousness exalts a nation. Sin is a disgrace to any people. We live in a democracy, and so this truth keeps us balanced. If righteous people do not vote, if righteous people do not run for office, can we be surprised that we are ruled by the wicked? We cannot. And yet, statistically, we continue to find that those who consider themselves evangelical Christians, the voting rate is less than half. Are we surprised? We've had a lot of words said among the evangelical community that actually has been against godly people, Christians, entering into government service. Well, if they're not there, then who is? It's an honorable profession to serve in that capacity. There's a lot of good biblical examples of it. Nehemiah, Daniel. At the same time, we keep in mind that our only real hope is in declaring the gospel and God granting revival. Not a political victory. It is right, it is good to work hard for a political victory. Even though the results of that are only temporal, it's a good thing to do. But do understand, we have a balanced view. Our true hope is in the gospel. It's in God granting revival. So as you pray for the next couple weeks, make that the heart of your prayer, that God in his graciousness would extend himself to bring a conviction of sin to our nation, upon which there can be repentance and revival.